Welcome to the first annual Darwin public lecture. It was, I think, the happy idea of Gay Woolven of the Center for Philosophy at the Natural and Social Sciences to celebrate the success of the Darwin seminar series by holding an annual Darwin public lecture, of which this is the first. We are honored by Professor John Maynard Smith as our first lecturer. Educated at Trinity College, Cambridge, he was for a time with us at London University before moving to Sussex in 1965 as the founding dean of biological sciences. And he is still Professor Emeritus there. His CV includes a long list of distinctions and prizes, including, happily, the Darwin Medal of the Royal Society in 1986, but many others also. His title tonight is Evolution and Development, Information or Self-Regulation.
First of all, am I plugged in and making a noise? Okay, thanks, right. Ever since I can remember, I think, biologists have been saying that if only we really understood development, it would transform the way we understand evolution. Indeed, I've even said it on occasions myself. The trouble has been that we don't understand development, or at least until recently we understood, I think, very little about it. And it really isn't very much good to an evolutionary biologist saying, oh, there are developmental constraints, if you don't know what the developmental constraints are or why they operate. And so, in effect, very little useful has been said by developmental biologists about evolution until rather recently. But things are changing, I want to talk about two very distinct reasons why they may be changing. The first has to do with the fact that we are living through a revolution in developmental genetics. For me, much the most important things that have been happening in biology during the past 10 years have been in the area of developmental genetics. It's still happening. As yet, I think it has had far less, so to speak, public impact than one might have expected, perhaps because it's technical and difficult and you'll be pretty confused about it by the time I've finished. I must emphasize that I'm, so to speak, free to say that about developmental genetics because I have contributed absolutely nothing. I mean, this is not my field. I'm an outsider to it, but fascinated by it. But at the same time, there's been a completely separate development in complex dynamical systems and attempts to apply ideas about complex dynamical systems to living organisms and the development of living organisms, which is much less mainstream as far as biologists are concerned, but nevertheless is, I think, important and interesting. So what I want to do this evening is really to try and do two things. First of all, to introduce you to some of the things that have been happening in developmental genetics. And this will be grossly oversimplified because of compression of time and partly of my own ignorance of the details. But also to try to introduce you to the alternative view of development. And finally, rather rashly perhaps, to suggest that these two schools might occasionally talk to one another. But first of all, what is the basis of my claim that there's a revolution in developmental genetics? It really hinges on the development of new techniques in molecular genetics, so that we are now able to identify genes which are important, whose action is important early in the development of embryos, to determine the DNA sequence of those genes, which by itself, of course, tells you nothing, it's just a useful tool, to decide and discover and make visible to us where and when in the early embryo particular genes are active, and I'll give you some examples of that later on, to knock out, as the phrase is, particular genes and find out what consequences, if any, this knocking out has, to cause such genes to become active in unusual places, and even to transfer them into very distantly related organisms, I mean from mice into fruit flies and so on, and find out what they do in totally strange places. None of these things were possible when I was working in development some 30 years ago. It just wasn't technically possible. It now is, and an enormous amount of work in that general area has been done. And I think a possible way of starting is to describe one really rather remarkable experiment by Walter Gehring and his colleagues, although as you'll see, the meaning of the experiment is perhaps not quite as obvious as one would like. The experiment consists of the following. There is in the mouse a gene called eyeless. It doesn't cause the mouse to be eyeless, but if you knock it out, the mouse doesn't have any eyes. So presumably the gene does something in the formation of eyes in the mouse. This gene was transferred into a fruit fly, and by techniques I'm not going to describe to you, for a rather good reason I do not fully understand them, this gene was activated in various places in the structure of the fruit fly, in the anatomy of the fruit fly. This is a photograph of the results of one such experiment. And we have something which is undoubtedly an eye. I want you to notice that it's certainly not a mouse eye. It's a compound eye of the kind you expect to find in a fruit fly. You can't tell from the photograph, but it's actually halfway down the fly's leg. What has happened is that a gene which normally is present in the mouse and which presumably sends a signal at some moment in the development of the mouse saying, make an eye here, has been transferred into the leg of the fruit fly, has given its signal saying, make an eye here, and what has happened is that the fly has indeed made an eye there, but it's not made a mouse eye, it's made a fly eye. Now, what does this actually mean? And it's not, let's say, quite as obvious as one might like. The obvious interpretation, and I think probably the right one, is that the common ancestor of mouse and fly had the ancestor of this gene, which is now represented in both mouse and fly, and in that common ancestor, it clearly did something, or it wouldn't have been there. It presumably, probably, but I want to emphasize it's only probable, signaled for the development of an eye-like structure in this very primitive common ancestor. The eye-like structure may have been no more than one or a small group of light-sensitive cells. But I think it's important to notice it's logically possible it didn't even signal for an eye. It could very well have signaled for something that wasn't an eye, but some other neurological structure. If so, it has a rather awkward assumption. You then have to assume that it evolved to change meaning independently in the ancestries, in the lineage leading to ourselves and to flies, in order to change its meaning to say, I. Now, I hope you've noticed from the way that I'm talking that I'm treating the gene and talking of it as if it were not only a signal, but more technically in the semiotic sense, as a symbol. That is to say, a signal whose meaning is actually independent of its structure. A word is a symbol in that sense. If I make the noise hoarse, it means something to you. Actually, it could mean two things to you, couldn't it, at least? I was thinking of the ungulate with one toe, but there's nothing about the noise hoarse which says it has to mean that. It is in that sense a symbol. I think that the regulatory genes that I shall be talking about this evening should be thought of as symbols in just that sense. And one reason why I think that is that some of the signal genes that I shall talk about later on have actually changed their meaning in the course of evolution. They used to mean one thing and now mean something else, or something else as well. They may mean the original thing and something new. Before I discuss the sort of deeper significance of that, let me give you one other example, a more general example. And I have to say, for me, perhaps the most dramatic thing I've learnt about biology during the last 10 years. This is purely diagrammatic. This is my idea of what a fly looks like. This is my idea of what a mouse looks like. or did at least look like when it was an embryo. There are in the mouse, in the fly, in Drosophila, a series of genes, there's more than four, there's I think seven or eight of them, but I've only drawn four, linearly arranged along a chromosome, which during the very early embryonic development of the fly, certainly long before it has antennae or eyes or legs or anything like that, these genes are activated, and they're activated serially from the front to the back of the body. So the first one, this one, is active in the head of the embryo, this one a little further back, this one a little further back, and the back one right at the back of the embryo. They're serially switched on along the embryonic body. It turns out that there's a very similar set of genes. These are called the HOM genes, these are the HOX genes, in the mouse. Also active in the embryo mouse, front, middle, back. And indeed, not only in mice and fruit flies, but we now know that they're active in a number of other organisms. I think all the main symmetric animal phyla have a series of homeobox genes linearly arranged down their bodies. Now, the startling thing, in a way, is that if you ask, well, at the beginning of these genes is something called a homeobox, which is a piece of DNA coding for some 60 amino acids, which is a structure which binds to DNA in a specific way. And it's a homeobox region that people have been thinking about in particular. If you ask, look at the homeobox region of this gene and ask, what other gene is most similar to it? It's not another gene in Drosophila, it's that one in the front of the mouse. And which gene is that most similar? It's that one. Which gene is that most similar to? It's that one. In other words, the anteroposterior signal, which was present in a common ancestor of fly and mouse, has been conserved in evolution for some 500 million years. Now, it so happens that these genes have, as a matter of fact, been duplicated in the vertebrate lineage. And in addition to doing their original job, the duplicate copies are now doing something else. I think I've got it right in saying that they are concerned, among other things, with the differentiation along the axis of the limb. So they've changed their meaning. In that sense, they do what words do. Words can keep their old meaning and acquire new ones. Genes, in this sense, can keep their old meanings and acquire new ones. So the first question I want to ask a little is, why conserve signals? Why are they so extraordinarily conservative over literally hundreds of millions of years? And the answer, I think, has to have something to do with evolution, clearly. And I think the explanation is of the following general kind. That these genes are, it turns out, arranged in a quite complex hierarchy of signals. You have a gene A which activates genes B, C, and D, and then genes B, C, and D activate another layer of genes. So there's a really quite complex hierarchy of instructions. It's more complicated than that. There are branching. It branches in the hierarchy. So that when you get down the bottom end, a particular gene will be influenced by the activity of all sorts of genes higher up the cascade of instructions. Now, the problem, a major problem about evolution, is how do you make changes which are selectively advantageous? Most random changes made to a motor car engine or most other structures are bad for it. Most typos are bad for, errors. Not all of them. I have actually, this is a digression, I don't know why I'm having a digression. I have once had an advantageous typo. Years ago, I referred in an article I was writing to Sod's Law. I assume you all know what Sod's Law is. My secretary, God bless her, typed it as God's Law. Turns out it'd be a lot better that way. But there is a real problem in any evolving system that at least some of the random changes that take place in DNA sequence should be selectively advantageous. As computer scientists who are working on this kind of problem nowadays have come to realize, one important requirement is that your mutations shouldn't, on the whole, make too big a change. Small changes are more likely to be helpful than big ones. And one thing you do not do, if you've got a hierarchy of genes of A instructing B, C, and D, and them instructing further down, you don't muck about with signal A. I mean, that's not going to be advantageous, whatever else further downhill may be. And I think, essentially, that is why the kinds of developmental regulatory genes that I've talked about, one for switching on an eye, one for switching on different structures in different parts of the fly or the mouse, aren't fiddled about with. Essentially, when changes do occur in those mutants, in those genes, and they indeed do, I'll show you one famous one. That fly is suffering from a mutation in one of its homeobox genes, and you notice it's got four wings instead of two wings. Its ancestors have had two wings for, I don't know, 100 million years? Probably more. Long time, anyway. But it's turned its halters back into wings. That's a mutation in a homeobox gene. You don't fiddle with those genes if you want to get somewhere. You fiddle with things further down the hierarchy. Now, I first realized just how important this homeobox story was from, I think, if I had to pick out one paper that had really influenced my thinking in the last 5 or 10 years, it would be a paper that appeared in Nature, and I'm bad at dates, a few years back, by Slack, oh my God, my neurons are remembering names, Graham and Holland, on precisely this issue. And they pointed out that there are actually two things that are conserved, a very different kind. There's the homeobox genes, this linear sequence of genes, have been conserved in animal evolution. And they suggest that it is that signaling system which is, in a sense, the defining characteristic of animals. The one thing that all animals have in common, they don't have much else in common, is this signaling system. And they call it the zoetype. But they point out that there's something else which is conserved in evolution, not quite to the same degree of obstinacy as the zoetype, but nevertheless to a very considerable degree of obstinacy, and that's what is called the phylotype. Now, this has been known for longer. Essentially, the notion is, and I do apologize that I'm telling the biologist among you things that you've known longer than I have, but not everybody here is a biologist. We've been known for quite a long time that the members of a given phylum, the vertebrates or the arthropods or the echinoderms or what you will, during their evolution go through a stage in which they are all exceedingly alike. In the vertebrates pass through what's called a phylotypic stage, in which they have along the middle of their backs a rigid rod called the notochord, above which they have a hollow nerve cord. Along either side of it, they have little blocks of tissue called somites, which will turn into either muscles or skeletal elements like ribs and so on. They have a pharynx, let's say, holes, gill slits in the front end of their gut and so on. So an embryo bird and an embryo fish and an embryo mammal look remarkably alike. There was a time when it was argued that this had to be true because during development, animals had, for some reason, to climb their own phylogenetic history. They had to repeat their own evolutionary history. It was a theory known as recapitulation. I don't think anyone takes recapitulation seriously now. I mean, the first question is, why on earth should we have to reclimb our evolutionary history? Nobody ever gave us any reason why recapitulation had to be so. But more fundamentally than that, observations show that actually before the phylotypic stage, embryos can actually be very different. And they, so to speak, converge on the phylotypic stage and then diverge again. They're very different earlier on because they may develop from a very large yolky egg or a small non-yolky egg and so on. But so again, we have a problem to do with conservation. And again, I think it has to do with evolution and the fact that only those changes that produce rather small alterations in adult phenotype are likely to get selected in evolution. You see, before the phylotypic stage, movements, embryonic processes tend to be global, affecting the whole embryo, and they involve massive cell movements, movements of gastrulation, for example. The result of these early things is to establish the phylotype, which is a stage when the different bits of the adult body are already represented by little blocks of more or less undifferentiated tissue in the right geometric relations to one another. What happens from then on is that the different blocks develop not wholly independently, because they do signal to one another to some extent, but to a large degree independently. In other words, development is modular in rather the same way that anybody who's written a computer program knows that a computer program is modular. You know, a computer program is full of subroutines and so on. And again, the sort of changes which are likely to be favored by natural selection are not changes prior to the phylotype, because they're going to have effects far too dramatic to lead to beneficial results, but changes much later in development. So the picture that's emerged from all this, or is emerging, is a picture of a complex hierarchy of regulatory genes determining the activity of other genes. Now, I hope at least those of you who are not biologists have been asking, it's all we're all talking about regulatory genes, and what is a regulatory gene? How does it regulate another gene and so on? I don't have time to go into the details of that, but it is actually really rather well understood, and was rather well understood, in fact, before anybody had done any work in developmental genetics, really. It in fact, is, for me, after the discovery by Watson and Crick of the structure of DNA, the most important biological discovery of this century was the discovery by Jacob and Monod about the way in which genes are switched on and off in bacteria. Because it turns out that system of switching genes on and off is present also in how organisms like ourselves. The only difference is we have a very much more complicated set of switches, so that in E. coli, a set of genes will be switched on perhaps by just a single inducer, whereas in ourselves, it may be a number of positive and a number of negative switches may have to be in the right position before something happens downstream. Well, so much for the moment for developmental genetics. I now want to talk about a completely different approach to the problem. And I want to talk for a little about the kinds of ways in which form could, in principle, develop. And I want to show you two forms. I'm going to start with the bottom one. I hope all of you, like me, are constantly working in the kitchen and recognize that form. It's the end of a potato masher. You know, you go like that if you want to mash potatoes, or so my wife tells me. That pattern has been produced by painting our potato masher with brown poster paint and stamping it on transparency. That's one way to make a form. It's what's called template reproduction. A solid object imposes its form on another solid object, in effect, by contact. Children are like their parents. Nobody actually believes in biology that we stamp out our children by an actual process of solidly pressing on them until they're the same shape as we are. However, template reproduction is, as I'm sure you know, absolutely fundamental in biology. It is a process upon which heredity depends. It's a process whereby DNA replicates itself. But it's not the process whereby you or I developed. This form is very different. I expect it's familiar to those of you who watch telly adverts, if nothing else. It's a form formed by water when you drop something into it. I think this isn't water because it's white, it's milk, I think, or something. How did that form get there? And I'm asking you now, not how did it get onto that paper, because it got onto that paper by a photographic process, but how did the form of which that is the photograph appear? It certainly wasn't a template. It's simply the consequence of a simple dynamical process depending upon things like the viscosity of water, the density of water, surface tension, and so on. And very simple dynamics can generate really rather surprisingly interesting shapes, and there is one of them. This form is, I think, a form which people who talk about it, use the phrase, would regard as a self-organized form. It's self-organized in two senses. It's not stamped out, but also, in the generation of the original form, there was no informational input. And I'd better talk about what I'm going to mean by informational input by showing you yet another form, which was generated by informational input. This is an important wine label used at the White House, and there's a fruit fly on it for the good reason that without fruit flies, yeast would never get from one grape to another. You don't realize the debt we owe to Drosophila, and there it is. Now, again, I'm not asking how did it get onto the paper, but onto the transparency, but how did it get onto the piece of paper from which I took that transparency? Well, it was drawn into my computer by a computer program I don't understand but can more or less use, and then passed from the computer to the printer. And the information, carrying the information about that structure, was present in a series of impulses traveling down the wire between the computer and the printer. And more than that, to each point of black in that picture, it would be possible to say that particular impulse or series of impulses in the wire switched on that point. I mean, there's a one-to-one correspondence, in other words, between the impulses in the wire connecting the computer to the printer and the black and white dots on the diagram. So although that wasn't stamped out, it was formed in response to an informational message. Now, as a geneticist, I naturally think that that 10 to the 9th bits of information, whatever it is, contained in a vertebrate genome, is carrying information about the form that is to develop. But it is not true that each point in my body is coded for by a particular piece of the DNA message. It is true that if you look at a protein, and I would like to be careful about this, if you look at the primary structure of a protein, that is to say, the sequence of amino acids in the protein, you can say of each amino acid what particular base, or in fact triplet of bases, specified that amino acid. There is a one-to-one correspondence between the information in the genetic message and the information in the primary structure of the protein. The protein then has to fold up. The structure is it causally determined by the primary structure of the amino acid, or it usually is, but the determination is through a fairly complex dynamical process which actually we still can't simulate. I mean, it really is a complex piece of dynamics which folds up the linear string of beads into a three-dimensional structure. But when it comes to the adult, there is no sense at all in which a particular triplet in the base, in the sequence of bases specifies a particular part of the body. So a problem when we come to talk about I've lost my place, you see, God help us. I think there were really two points that I wanted to make from that. One is that let me just pause and see whether my mind comes back. Let me go back to talk about the splash. The splash is certainly self-organized in the two senses that it's not stamped out and there's no information instructing, as far as we know. It's just a consequence of some dynamics. A developmental biologist might say, well, that's not really very interesting because it's too evanescent. It only is there for a split second before it collapses. I don't actually think that argument really holds up very much water. I don't mean water, sorry. I don't think it's a very sensible argument. You can generate stable, stationary patterns by dynamical processes as well as evanescent ones. I just, for reasons that will become apparent later, I wanted to show you that particular one. So the possibility does exist that morphology, as we look at it, is a consequence of the kind of dynamical process that is illustrated by the splash of water, and that different shapes are specified by altering the parameters. In the case of the water splash, it would have to be things like the surface tension, the force of gravity, things of that kind, the viscosity, and that what the genes are doing is simply altering the parameters of the system. And by altering the parameters you put into the dynamical system, you can get different shapes. Now let me go back to Drosophila for a moment. There is a logic in this. I believe there's a logical thread in what I'm saying, but it won't be apparent to all of you. And show you another picture of Drosophila. That, in fact, is a tracing of a photograph. It's not the actual photograph itself. This is the egg of a fruit fly, very early on, before any structure is visible, except if you actually make it visible. The blue dots here are positions, nuclei in fact, where a particular gene called even-skipped, or EVE for short, is switched on. In those nuclei, the gene EVE is active. The red dots refer to genes in which a gene called Fushi Tarazu, and someone after me can tell me how it got that funny name, I don't know, is switched on. Now, I can remember vividly first seeing not that particular photograph, but a similar photograph, and it completely blew my mind, and I should explain to you why. Back in 1952, the British mathematician Alan Turing proposed, he wrote a paper called The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis, in which he showed that if you have a set of chemically reacting system substances free to react and free to diffuse, and nothing else, although usually the result was to finish up with a boring homogeneous distribution of products, there were certain values of the reaction rates and the diffusion rates in which that uniform distribution was unstable, and in fact it would break up into a standing wave. It took a long time before people, chemists, actually managed to realize this, but there now are actual, so to speak, real chemical reactions giving you a standing wave, according to the receipt that Turing proposed. Now, back when Turing came up with this idea, I became really obsessed with it, and I thought, God, Turing waves are marvelous, they explain everything. Fingers, petals, you know, any repeated structure, as Turing hoped, I think, that they would. But I did add just one slight wrinkle to it, which was to point out that, for reasons I can't go into the details of, a Turing wave wouldn't, if you wanted to produce five fingers every time, and almost everybody in this room, probably everybody has five fingers on both hands, that's okay. But if you wanted to produce 15 fingers, you couldn't do it with a Turing wave in one step. What you'd probably have to do would be to make five peaks and then divide each of those into three. You'd have to multiply, in other words. Now, what's happened here, each of these stripes is going to turn into a Drosophila segment. The Drosophila, 14 segments, but they're doing it with only seven waves, seven peaks. And I thought, God, Drosophila's read my paper. You know, I really felt very good for a brief while. Sadly, I have to tell you that it's not so. Almost certainly, this is not a Turing wave. The brief reason why it's not a Turing wave is that the different peaks of concentration of the gene EVE, if it were a Turing wave, each one of them should be switched on by the same morphogen, the concentration of the same chemical substances. Not so. Different peaks are switched on by different morphogens or different combinations of morphogens. In the word of Dr. Akam, which I liked, flies make their stripes inelegantly. The elegant way of doing it would be to do it the way that Turing suggested, but unfortunately they hadn't read Turing's paper, they hadn't even read my gloss on it, and they went right ahead and did it a silly way. Um, However, if I got it wrong, and this is way back, we're talking about the 60s, my friend Lewis Wolpert, rather annoyingly, probably got it right. And there's nothing more annoying than getting something wrong than having one of your friends get something right. It shouldn't be, but it is. Essentially, and this is a caricature, and Lewis will have to squirm while I describe it and get it wrong. Lewis's idea, he called it the French fag problem. And the basic notion is the following. Supposing as a pattern, you want to divide what is initially a uniform line of cells, and there they are, into three regions, red ones, white ones, and blue ones, like a French flag. How do you do it? And the idea is that you first establish what Lewis called a gradient of positional information. Now, positional information could be a number of things. The simplest way, but not the only way by any means, would be to make some stuff at one end of the sheet and allow it to diffuse across the sheet so that you would have a gradient from a high concentration to a low concentration. And then you would wire up your genes, which you do this, we know this works quite well, so that if they were high concentration, they switched on the gene for making red pigment, and if they were subjected to a very low concentration, they switched on the gene for making blue pigment, and if they weren't in either of those states, they just didn't make any pigment at all, and it was something, or made a third kind of pigment. Now, there's a limit to the amount of complexity you can produce in one step by such a process. Lewis won't remember this, but I can remember quite vividly taking him to the zoo and pointing at a zebra and said, Lewis, do you really believe there's a monotonic gradient from the head to the tail of that zebra, such that at every even number it's got a black stripe and every odd number it's got a white stripe? And even Lewis didn't defend that position. I wanted it to be a Turing wave, of course, on the zebra. And it probably is, I don't know. But at least that is one of the ways in which Drosophila is making its patterns. Not the only way. The first thing that happens to pattern an early Drosophila embryo is this. There's a Drosophila egg. Here are three of mother's cells, so-called nurse cells, which manufacture substances and release them into the egg. There's a gene in the mother, well, in the embryo too, but it's a gene in the mother that's doing the work, called bicoid, which makes, in the first instance, messenger RNA, which is shoved into the egg. That mRNA is then translated into the bicoid protein, which then diffuses back down the body of the egg and produces a gradient. And that gradient is one of the gradients. It's by no means the only one, which is responsible for the later differentiation of specific regions in the embryo. I don't want you for one moment to look at this bit, really. Well, just for one moment, because that gives you a greatly oversimplified account of some of the events going on downstream of bicoid of other sets of genes, with ever such jolly names like hunchback and so on, which are being switched on, and which, in combination, generate the pattern that I showed you earlier. So it's bad luck. It doesn't look as if the beautiful pattern of stripes in Drosophila is generated as a Turing wave, but I still have hopes, and I believe in doing science the anecdotal way. No damned experiments. That is an object, I hope you'll all recognize it as an echinoderm test, which Sheila and I, my wife and I, bought for sixpence on Penzance Pier in about 1960, at a stage when I was obsessed by Alan Turing. You may know something slightly funny about it. It has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 main rays. Since the Cambrian, echinoderms have been 5 radial. This particular guy's got 6. It's Anne Boleyn among echinoderms. I like to think that there is indeed a Turing wave forming around echinoderms, but this one's just got in 6 peaks instead of 5 because the parameters have been just slightly badly set. Perfectly possible. But it's pure speculation. I don't know what it is. There are better evidences for Turing waves than that. Angelfish, for example, Sadly, I've been so bullied in the last week that I didn't get time to get to the library and get some nice pictures of angelfish, and I apologize. Okay, but the best evidence, I think, for dynamical processes in development come from organisms which are composed of only a single cell. And I'm now going to talk about the work of another friend of mine, Brian Goodwin, carried out in part in Sussex. This is a curious, it's a plant, I suppose, single-celled plant called Acetabularia. It's quite big, you can see it with the naked eye. It's not a tissy little thing, several centimetres high as an adult, but it consists just of a single cell. It develops from a cell like this, which grows a little stalk. Stalk gets longer and forms little sort of leaflets, and ultimately the leaflets drop off and it produces this extremely complex cap on the top. Now, you cannot, however else you explain that those phenomena, you cannot say it's done by switching off on different genes here and here from in the stalk, because there's only one set of genes and they're down the bottom. The gene products are being carried up the stem by streaming, but there's only one set of genes. It really cannot be that different genes are being switched on in different places. I'm taken too long over this talk, and I've got to rush ahead a bit. At least these structures, the rings of leaflets which appear, this is the growing tip of the stalk growing up, and as it grows, these rings of leaflets appear at intervals. We have at least got some notion of how that works, and it does work by a fairly complicated piece of dynamics, which I don't have time to describe in any detail, but these are taken from a book recently published by Brian Goodwin and his colleague Gary Webster. The essential point is that the tube is fluid-filled, or a fluid center, with cytoplasm as it forming a ring round it. So it's a cytoplasmic tube with water in the middle. And the cytoplasm contains proteins of various kinds, including fibrous proteins, you know, some of which are elastic and some of which are actually contractile. And further, the behavior of these proteins depends upon the calcium concentration, and their activity alters the calcium concentration. And for those reasons, as you can imagine, you can get some fairly complicated dynamics. What Brian Goodwin and his colleague Lynn Trainer did was to try to define those interactions as well as they could, and to simulate the concentration of calcium in a growing stalk. And the essential point is that they were able to show that the concentration of calcium would not remain uniform, but would break up, first of all, into a ring of high concentration with a low area in the middle and a ring of higher concentration around the edge. And then, if you disturb that ring, even slightly, you get something of a rather dramatic kind, a wave-like arrangement of calcium concentration, illustrated by this red series of peaks here. If, as it's entirely reasonable, one treats calcium concentration as something which is going to induce the formation in the appropriate place of a leaflet, you have a model of how the leaflets are formed. I think it's fair to say that nobody has the remotest idea how the cap is formed. But however it's done, it has to be a dynamic. This dynamics may not be quite right, but it's got to be done by some sort of dynamical process. It's not done by switching on different genes and different bits of the cap, however else it may be done. Okay, so I really have mucked myself now. I've wholly lost my notes. Oh, dear, 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 dear. Right. So we've got sort of two processes, or two views of process. One is a view of a sort of global and dynamic system. The other one is one in which interactions are very local, very molecular, and depend critically on genetic information. And I think it's fair to say that the proponents of these two points of view do not often communicate, although two of them are separated by only one intermediate filament, and maybe at any minute something will happen. So one never knows. I was fascinated. I don't think this debate between reductionist and global models is by any means confined to developmental biology. I was fascinated a few months back. I was asked to attend a meeting organized by neurobiologists and roboticists at the University of Sussex, and was fascinated to discover that they too were having this kind of row between people who believe in dynamical systems as a useful approach to the designing of robots and those who thought programs of the kind that I write, with a begin and an end every now and then and an if and a then and so on, was the right way to do it. And it was clear that it was the same kind of conflict going on among those people as is going among developmental biologists, with the difference that they were actually talking to one another. Now I think, I have to say this because I'm at the LSE, you understand, I think this context is at least in part an ideological context. And I'd like to start, if I may, with an anecdote. This goes way back to the days when I was an undergraduate at University College after the war studying zoology. I was taught genetics by Hans Grüneberg, who was an early and very persuasive proponent of the view that genes control development. And I can remember putting on a large cartoon on the notice board that the undergraduates occupied with four horses labeled genes and a carriage, and a little man sitting on the pavilion of the carriage with a whip in his hand. And Grüneberg thought he was pretty easy to caricature, and he was clearly Grüneberg, his great whip, and the slogan was genes control development. And the fact that I drew that cartoon suggests to me that perhaps I had some kind of inner hostility to the notion. I have to reveal to you another fact, that it won't be known to all of you, which was in those days. I was a Marxist, albeit one whose Marxist convictions were crumbling rather rapidly, nevertheless they were still more or less in situ. I felt there was a kind of contradiction between this very hierarchical control attitude and the geneticists and a decent attitude towards politics. And I do observe, I think it's true on this side of the Atlantic, but I'm not sure it's true on the other side, these things are very local, that it really is true that those people in Britain who are enthusiastic for what I would call a holistic view of development, tend to be well on the left of the political spectrum. I don't for one moment want to suggest that all the reductionists voted the wrong way last Thursday. I mean, don't get me wrong. But there is, I think, a trend that way. And it isn't just confined to the ideology, not just a political one. I was fascinated recently reading Evelyn Fox Keller, who was a really quite effective theoretical biologist who became a feminist critic of science, arguing that molecular biology could be seen as analogous to a sort of male domination of nature, where nature is imaged as being female. And she clearly felt that there was this ideological parallel between the reductionist view and a really rather reactionary view towards the relationship between the sexes. Now, most scientists confronted with this sort of thing would just say, oh, this is rubbish. You know, these matters have to be settled by the evidence. And of course, in a sense, I agree. But I don't think it can be quite that easy to settle them. I mean, if two people as both as well-informed, and if they'll forgive me for saying so, as intelligent as Brian Goodwin and Lewis Wolpert, can disagree as passionately and as continuously and for as long over this matter, it cannot just be quite as trivial an issue to settle as you might think. I think part of the problem is that these arguments between reductionists and holists, in whatever field they arise, are not primarily arguments about what the world is like. They're arguments about what the best way of us discovering what the world is like is. They're questions about research strategy rather than about the nature of the world. And it's easy for me as an outsider, you see, I have no intention whatever of doing any experiments in developmental biology during the next 15 years. I don't have to make up my mind which horse to back. But if you're going to put your resources of intellect, of effort, of time, of money and so on, into an actual research program, you mind desperately which particular way of going forward is the better one, and you feel pretty resentful if somebody suggests that a different way might be better. As an outsider, I have no difficulty at all in saying, look, I think, finally, an understanding of development is going to depend upon both kinds of approaches. We need genetic information, genetic control, but we also need dynamics. And they really, each of them really are going to understand, have to understand what the other one is saying, I believe. But finally, because I'm at the LSE, I want to mention a curious paradox. It is a paradox to me. You see, in biology at least, the analogue is on the whole. If you're on the left, you're a holist. If, like me, you're a kind of fascist liberal of some kind, you're a reductionist. But what about economics? The best example known to me of a successful self-organization theory anywhere in the sciences, I think, has to be Adam Smith's notion of the hidden hand. The notion that an effective economic system is best arises if individuals act, are free to act, in their own self-interest. And thus, through market forces, you finish up with a well-integrated society. Now, I'm aware that that's a caricature of what Adam Smith said, but it's caricatures of what people who lived 300 years ago, exaggeration, 200 years ago, it's a caricature, but caricatures are often about right when people have been dead that long. You've extracted what the essence of the argument is. Yet Adam Smith's vision of the hidden hand was, let's face it, the philosophy of the government we've just got rid of. I don't know what socialists think now. I know what they used to think when I was a boy, which basically was that things should be directed from the center. A lot of information should be pumping into the system, a lot of direction and control. So the sides have changed. It leaves me with the deep conviction that we shouldn't take these, we should be aware that we have these ideological convictions, because of course we do, but we shouldn't be too much influenced by them if we can help it. Thank you.
It is a long-established tradition at the Darwin Public Lectures, starting tonight, that the audience can ask questions or make criticisms of the speaker. And Professor John Maynard Smith has agreed to inaugurate that tradition. Yes.
The reason I chose the work of my colleague Brian Goodwin as a representative, if you like, of the dynamical system, holistic view of development, rather than Stu Kaufman, is that there does seem to me an important difference between them. I think that Brian knows and minds what the world is like. I don't believe that Stu Kaufman, he may know, but I don't think he cares much. I spent 2 long weeks on separate occasions at the Santa Fe Institute, and it seemed to be completely fact-free science. The only time anybody mentioned a fact, it was either me, or the fact turned out not to be a fact, but the result of a computer simulation. And I really do believe that science is... I'm a theorist, for God's sake. I believe in theory and science. I really do. But I do think it's important that theory should be made, should stand the test of observation. And I don't see much the sign of that in Stu, who's a friend of mine also. But I really think he's fact-free.
You mentioned information on several occasions. Perhaps I'm wrong, but the context in which I interpreted you having mentioned information was that in adaptive systems there is information, in gene-directed systems, but not in self-organizing systems. Is that right? In other words, you mentioned it in your economic values.
Yes. I think you may have correctly reported what I said, but I'm not, it isn't really a correct report of what I think. I mean, these ideas are hard to be precise about. I mean, clearly in gene control systems, the information simply has to be there. However, in a system like the acetabularia system, it clearly is an adaptive system. I mean, that structure is adapted very well to make the little alga live and survive and so on. It's clearly, for reasons I gave, has to be a dynamic system, but the information, which must clearly be present in the genes of the acetabularia, is having its influence on the structure by presumably determining things like the properties of the cell wall, the properties of the fibers of the proteins in the cytoplasm, their elasticity, their response to calcium. It's doing a lot of parameter setting, in other words. And so you can have information forming a structure by setting the parameters of dynamical systems. And that's a perfectly possible hybrid between the two kinds of approach. Is that answering your question or not? Come back at me, because I think I was confused.
No, I'm actually curious about the way that you define information in this context. Is information something that only adaptive systems in the evolutionary sense have? In other words, systems that are adapted to a specific set of environmental circumstances, or is information something that can be contained in an adaptive, dynamical, organizing, say, chemical system that isn't evolutionary? Is it inextricably linked with the concept of function?
Yeah. I don't know whether everyone heard that. It's a quite profound question, and I'm going to repeat it, if only to embarrass myself, because I'm not sure I know what the answer is. But the question really is the notion of information confined to systems which are adaptive in the sense that living organisms are adaptive or machinery is adaptive, or could it be applied simply to a physical system like a cloud or a whirlpool or that little splash that I showed you and so on? That's the question, and I'm not sure what the answer ought to be. I think of information entirely in the former context, of the context in which the genes have been programmed by millions of years of natural selection, if you like, in order to produce an adaptive structure. And that if they hadn't had that programming, that you could still string together a sequence of bases, but you wouldn't say it was information because it wouldn't have any adaptive meaning. So I think I want to confine the use of information to the context where there has been a history of natural selection programming the information that is being translated. But if somebody can show me, and they may do at the reception, that that's a silly way of looking at it, I could easily change my mind. I mean, I think it's a quite deep question, difficult question. Well, look, I'm not sure it takes you either way. See, I don't think that you can have a theory of development which doesn't have dynamics in there. And I'm sure you can't have a theory of development that doesn't have information in there. I mean, you've got to have both concepts. You can't even fold up a protein without dynamics, for God's sake, you know, let alone produce arms and legs and things. So whichever way you play it, you're going to have both dynamical systems and information. The fascinating thing to me about the acetabularia experiments are the following. One's impression of Drosophila development or mouse development and so on is that the dynamical systems are probably rather dull and rather boring. I mean, after all, diffusion is a dynamical process. But it's a dull dynamical process. Not much in the way of pattern comes out of it, you know, it's not exciting. A Turing wave is getting quite exciting. A series of leaflets is really mind-blowing and so on. Clearly, if you've only got one nucleus, you've got to do some pretty cunning dynamics if you want to generate a complex structure like a ciliate or a one of these big algae and so on. My impression is that in the higher organisms, they've got so much information, they don't have to generate much dynamical complexity per step. You know, they can just do a little each time. But that's a very superficial impression. I mean, I think we'll have to know a lot more about things like segment formation and how all these processes, I mean, how fingers work, how all these things work, before we can really be sure. But at the moment, my gut feeling is that As a tabulary does it, that makes very complex dynamics because it's got to. If you don't have to, you know, why not use baby dynamics? I didn't catch that question. Did you catch it? Sorry, I want you to say it louder. I'm getting deaf in my old age. The question is concerned with neoteny and whether one of the sort of major hierarchical genes has been switched off around. It's interesting that the one idea from developmental biology, which was really part of what I call the modern synthesis of evolutionary biology, and it was something I was taught as an undergraduate in the 40s, the late 40s and early 50s, was the notion of, well, not just of neoteny, but of heterochrony, of altering the rates of different developmental processes and getting interesting results out of it. I had the good fortune to be taught, among other people, by Gavin De Beer, who was the author of that fascinating book, Embryos and Ancestors. And the notion basically was that important things happen in evolution because by altering the relative rates of different processes. What I find disappointing is that I don't think you can give many good examples of that phenomenon that De Beer didn't give. It doesn't seem to me to be an idea which has grown in the last 50 years in the way one would expect an idea of that kind to grow if it was really important. But certainly some processes do happen by neoteny, including, it's been suggested, some of the processes that make us such a funny shape. You know, the argument there's quite good, but that's in De Beer. And not much has happened since. So I'm kind of rather off heterochrony at the moment.
We are now coming against the clock. Although no doubt there are some people wanting to rush to tell our speaker where the name of the Fushi-Terrazu gene came from, they are invited to do so upstairs, where there will be a reception in the senior dining room on the fifth floor, to which everyone is cordially invited to carry on the discussion. Professor Maynard Smith, it's always a pleasure to hear a lecture by a master of the art of lecturing. And it's especially so when a large part of the audience are social scientists struggling to understand how they can, their own disciplines are going to be influenced by developments in the natural sciences, and how understanding the principles of development in these sciences can enable us to learn from each other. Thank you very much.